it is from parents. In any case, it doesn't tell anything.
Okay, is this working?
So.
Well, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to talk about my work and for the opportunity to visit Canada and the Perimeter Institute for the first time. Where is my project? So, well, I'm going to talk about some few ideas about the consistency of the interacting quantum field theories in the sphere space-time, which are based mostly in this work with my advisor Enrique Álvarez. So, well, since the sphere space-time is well, it's sort of the basic arena for the inclusionary cosmology and also for the dark energy plate time, the dark energy dominated plate time cosmology. But also, since it is the one of the simplest Kepler space times, it's nice just to have a good theoretical understanding of the quantum field theory defined over this manifold. So, over the whole manifold, in fact, because I'm going to focus mainly in the whole hyperboloid, which we have seen a lot of times between yesterday and today. I encourage you to choose a different picture, for example, a picture within the sphere that hasn't appeared so far. So, well, those are the questions that I would like to understand, which could be. Can we get a sensible interacting vacuum for the sphere space? Can we get it perturbating just from the free vacuum, just as we do in flat space-time? And is this going to preserve the sphere symmetry?
You can tell us what is your criterion for sensible time?
Not exactly, but don't worry. There will be some for clusters. There are kind of two different approaches to this question. Of course, I'm aware that you can work just in the sphere and try this fancy analytic continuation that is working really well, and connecting the so you're connecting this theory to the thermal nature of the theory of the quantum field. Its thermal nature in the space time, but I'm going to focus in these aspects that have been pointed out in the literature about the possibility of a vacuum decay, starting with this formalism of perturbating the free vacuum, and also the connection between this phenomena and the possibility of have forbidden of having forbidden processes in a Kepler space time, which is a generic feature of the theory. So this proposal by Polyakov that we have heard about this morning, it's based on the fact that if you think that the analytic continuation is the right way to do things in the sphere space time, then you're going to miss something that doesn't look trivial, which is the fact that you can get a finite imaginary part for the vacuum energy in some sense. So, in particular, if we are thinking in a Lambda Phi 4 theory, then it was shown in this work, I'm going just to summarize the results. You can get an imaginary part, a finite imaginary part for this diagram. This diagram here, well, it corresponds just to this expression with the Vance Davis propagator. I'm not denoting it, but that's the basic free vacuum that everybody is thinking of. So, well, this is proportional to the space-time volume, because of the homogeneity of the integral, and then it can be shown that you can get with some clever tricks you can get a finite imaginary part for this diagram. So you have the amplitude, well, I'm not so sure about the I factors, but there you have the amplitude, which of course is divergent with respect to this thing to be divergent. But the thing is that with these clever tricks, you can get this result. So we have here the propagator, which depends only on the geodesic distance, and we get this funny measure. So it's logical from the point of view that so if this kind of equivalent to the radial measure for a sphere.
Is there any need to be normalized here, or is it finite?
Well, you need to normalize in some sense, because well, this is a...
But then if I need to be normalized, how can I understand this interval? It's only interval over there.
Presumably the real part is
yeah, the
infinite,
real part
but not the imaginary
part. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was my question, yeah.
Well, the imaginary part is just three-level. It's just optical theorem he's using.
Yeah. No, well, that's the point. That's going to be the main thing of this talk. This is, you can relate it to three-level process. But anyway, I can tell you that the way this calculation was done was kind of a dimensional regularization in position space. So yes, you get some divergent parts, but I think they don't matter for the
imaginary part. Okay.
So it's immediate to think that this is going to give us some instability of the vacuum in some sense, and try to relate it to the runaway particle production in an eternal the Sitter space. Well, this was done. This paper was discussed some Boltzmann equation to try to understand this runaway particle production. So these processes are related to what Jürgen Moskela has told us about, in some sense, because so in this work. We have these those remarkable results for the dynamical part of the theory. So now we have everything well defined for the in this so the dynamics in some sense the theories in the Shannon-Lehmann quotes that we know that are completely well defined now after this this paper. But of course here. They didn't try to calculate anything related to vacuum decay, but in some sense, I want to stress that this is extremely related to the previous approach, in the sense that Microsoft didn't allow us to see some formula, but what is the thing for Jason? So, I'm just going to quote basically the amplitude. The amplitude that is calculated in some sense corresponds to any state is mine, not from the data, of course. This is more or less the formula I'm giving this work. So what I want to stress is that the process, the calculational method that is being used here is mostly the theory, starting with the free vacuum, and try to regularize it with this some asymptotic cutoff. So what? At this point, I would like to talk about this idea of how can we study.
Yeah. On the previous slide, you had the decay split in two parts. I don't understand what that equation means, or what's the physical content of that.
What is L of psi?
Oh, sorry. This is the information that we couldn't see because of this hangar. So, well. Do you want to answer for me?
No.
Right.
So, this is the decay rate. This L of psi, this part only depends in principle on the initial wave function, because we are calculating the decay of something, some initial state, well, it's better, zero, whatever here. And then you have the Celent-Lehmann, the Celent-Lehmann wave. So this is completely general in principle, as far as I understand. The dynamical part is perfectly well defined in this part. And then we have here the kinematics of the initial state and you have to include also here the cutoff, the adiabatic cutoff.
It's a bunch of this vacuum? Or?
Yeah, sure. No. I mean, for this process, it's an initial fog particle.
Oh, okay.
A fog is excitation over the bands that is like. At this point, I would like to talk about this nice idea that we can use the unitarity of the theory to understand the relation between. Well, this is kind of a trivial thing in some sense, because of course, if we think, for example, any one-dimensional quantum mechanics example that we can think of, a wave function peaking on the false backwards is going to leak to some other place. Obviously, it's from the point of view of just the modes around this false backward. I'm not specifying what is happening here, but of course, if this wave function is peaking here and this is going to leak to another place, from the point of view of these modes, it's quite obvious that these modes are going to be excited. I mean, forget about this example. It's better to understand for the case of the sphere space just a harmonic oscillator with a time-dependent frequency. So it will start with the vacuum. Of course, if the frequency varies with time, then with respect to the old modes, in some sense, this is going to be like an excitation, a creation of particles. So, about unitarity, this is quite trivial. Forget for a second this H matrix notation that could be controversial, but. We have this unitary S matrix. Of course, we know how to relate the imaginary part of an amplitude with the products of amplitudes of lower orders. So, in particular, I'm thinking in this relation, this optical theorem applied to the vacuum. So, in this particular case, we have. That the imaginary part of the vacuum is just the total cross section of the particles produced in this process. And for those of you that doesn't like to talk about H matrix, let me tell you that you can talk just in terms of largest time equation. So largest time equation is kind of a unitarity relations in position space. So we have this kind of equation, which is mostly equivalent. These are, let's say, position space amplitudes, and this is a sum over cuttings. And well, this real part means imaginary part, just some I factors. So, the way to justify this alternative, or this equivalent, in fact, for flat space times. Approach to unitarity that only depends in the way that we define the propagators. So since we define our propagators in terms of this time argument, the Weinmann function of the two-point function, this is guaranteed to work in the sense that any amplitude that we can construct is going to verify this equation. So here the cuttings. The cuttings here just replace the propagators with a sum over intermediate states that give us a two-point function, a Weinmann function.
I guess this is guaranteed to work in the principal series, right? Is that what you're talking about? Massless particles. You have massless fields, it's much less clear.
You mean?
In terms of Ugo's talk earlier.
Yeah, but
for constructing Green's functions from Whiteman functions, everything works just as you expect, as it does in flat space for the massive representation, the principal series. Are you assuming that?
Sure, there is a problem in the zero case.
Yeah, so are you making a statement that applies also there, or?
No, not there, but not there. As you were saying, massive case, well, I'm talking, there is these two representations here, I'm talking in principle for both of them. I mean, the high masses and the lower masses here. The complementary and the, but not the massless, totally massless scale.
Mm-hmm. So your dynamical system is a massive scale of field.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, the only simple case is the conformally coupled case, the massless conformally coupled case, and this you will see that doesn't work quite well.
What doesn't work? This is not true. What does?
Well, I guess it's true, but we get this. We get the usual divergence. We'll see in a minute.
Okay.
And just to understand, you say this works for any amplitudes. Do you mean both in out and in correlators, or?
No, I guess this approach starts with some kind of in out assumption. So right. Since we are perturbating over the free vacuum. To see how this works, I'm going to talk a little bit about a really simple, oversimplified toy model, which is taking this lambda phi 3 theory with a time-dependent coupling. So, what we introduce here is this time scale for the cosine, and then, of course, we're going to get some particle creation. Of course, this cosine was chosen just to give us this really simple new vertex that conserves free momenta but doesn't conserve energy. So in every vertex now we have three terms who are conserving energy and two giving a constant input or output of energy. The previous equality that I was considering now is this one. So now it's lambda phi 3, but this was chosen just for the sake of simplicity. This is a quite trivial example because, of course, it's really easy to understand that this is equivalent to a lambda phi 4 theory with a constant energy in the external legs. So here, when we calculate the imaginary part of this diagram, this is completely equivalent to the imaginary part of the setting sun diagram with putting this energy scalar in the external lines. So this happening, this horrible integral here, this notation is standard in high loops computations. So regarding this cross section, this is completely equivalent to the decay of a massive particle with mass eta to three particles of mass m, and this is just the regular Dalitz plot like phase space factor that you have to integrate to get this k rate. And of course, this works, this is guaranteed to work because of the. Because we know that this is just flat space theory. This was drawn in the context of trying to understand to classificate those horrible integrals on higher loops calculations. So, you can wonder if the tadpoles are going to, if the weight is going to hold for the tadpoles also. You could get rid of them just for normally, but from a formal point of view, it's nice to see that this still works and we did that. So they add some extra contribution to the previous equality, to the previous equation, but you see that they have to cancel each other independently of, from the previous relation. So, well, what can this tell us about the notion of binding decay or and particle production? So this is a really well understood physical system. And I can think in a really oversimplified Boltzmann equation that only takes in account this process and the inverse, and I'm ignoring the other ones. So, well, in this really simple Boltzmann equation, it's clear that I'm going to achieve some kind of stationary state when the density of particles is high enough to compensate the vacuum decay rate. So this other term is because of the inverse process, right? I guess it's obvious. We are just subtracting these two quantities.
You're neglecting one.
It
doesn't satisfy detailed balance, you know, where, right?
This
equation doesn't satisfy detailed balance. So.
I expect to achieve some kind of a stationary regime.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Detailed balance is when a collision integral is zero, right? But he has non-zero, or you expect.
In this oversimplified model, but I guess that the physical picture is clear. If the density is high enough to provide the opposite process, then you are going to see the detailed balance.
Yeah, it's
the
annihilation. It's just annihilation.
The annihilation. Let me add some arrow.
Right. But it's too simplified because you're neglecting the
of course.
Yeah. The build-up of the population.
Yeah. Sure.
What I meant, this sort of. I mean, 1 plus n of the input rate, right? That's what you neglect.
The one, sorry?
Well, I mean, this
one part is in the initial state.
There is this Bose enhancement, what's called, right? That you neglect.
There is a stimulated term.
Oh, exactly.
In the
0
to 3, because of the buildup of the population.
Mm-hmm. But that would be
that's
easy,
what I meant,
that would be easy to include.
Yeah, yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
So, where would I? So now in this simple model, it's easy to understand the relation between the imaginary the.
Excuse me. The Boltzmann equation is superimposed, or it comes out of the original theory.
What do you mean superimposed?
I mean, now you have this model, and you think that there is some sort of Boltzmann equation, or else there is a derivation of this equation starting from principles.
No, I don't think so. But
superimposed.
It's superimposed in some sense, but I think it's
just a question.
Yeah. So we didn't check if there is some non-trivial modification of the regular Boltzmann equation, but.
Because also in Polyakov approach, I don't understand very well if it is superimposed, Boltzmann equation, or it comes out of something.
Well, I think that
you can derive it by neglecting the self mass correction. I mean, the self energy correction.
Even inside the quantum field theory.
Yeah. But it's not controller approximation.
That's another question. So I think just for these purposes, it's just imposed.
Well, so I was saying that it's easy to understand now that this particle creation makes our quantum state to rotate in the Hilbert space, and that's just easy to understand the meaning of this imaginary part. So now we get to some final state that has slightly rotated with respect to the initial state. Of course, there are a couple of caveats if we try to transport this lesson from this oversimplified model to the super space. Because of course, we keep in mind always that the asymptotic regions, this for asymptotic, I mean, this, using this in-out theory in the super space is not completely well understood. Well justified, I would say. And also, well, it was at first sight we thought of using this this model to just translate it into the equivalent curve Lagrangian, the equivalent Lagrangian of a lambda phi whatever theory in a Freeman Brothers of Welfare or something. So, but well, for this model, doesn't work, and it's really too simple. And if you want to do it, you have to allow the mass to vary with time and something.
What's wrong with that?
Hmm?
What's wrong with that?
With allowing the mass to vary with time?
Yeah. I wanted a simple analogy.
Nothing, I guess. I mean, nothing. Just saying that it's more complicated. So, well, going back to the Sitter space, of course, and now we have to face the problem if we want to apply this lesson to the Sitter space, that the functional form of the propagators is really much more complicated. So, of course, the first idea that we had was trying to analyze the Magnusson formally coupled case, which is a simple idea, but we found some that have some problems. But there are, in fact, some results. You can do this calculation more like easily. There is this paper by Hatsushi Higuchi, where he derives this part of the quality for the cosmological patch, and he gets out this final result in a really simple way.
It looks like he's got zero imaginary part there, right? Is that correct?
No, this is this part of the diagram, this part of the quality.
So how can the conforming of the Magnusson conformally coupled thing show any imaginary part? Looks like yeah. Is it due to conformal?
Well, it should be related, I guess, but
I don't understand as well. You use lambda phi. Is it used like lambda phi to the fourth?
Yeah.
So it's conformal theory completely. Yeah, it doesn't distinguish flat space from the sitter. Okay. Why this amplitude is not zero?
This you're asking about this amplitude, right?
Yeah.
Why
gamma is not zero?
Well, the same as in flat space. If you conformally transform.
You conformally transform, you get something in flat space. Should be zero.
Yeah, should be zero. Okay.
Do you mean particle theory can in specific can be done in flat space then?
If it is massless conformally coupled with lambda phi to the force, the theory is just completely conformally.
Right. So you can
on the tree level it's completely
conformally. Yeah, well, so it's conformally equivalent to half of
yes.
Well, you can do the same on Einstein's static universe, this amplitude will be zero.
No.
It will.
Topologically, they are different, by the way.
But I know. But on Einstein's static universe, this amplitude is zero.
It has to do with the fact that he's studying with it.
Let's him.
So it's different.
It's not a question to you, it's a question.
It is equivalent to doing phi to lambda phi fourth in half of Minkowski.
Well, let's do that on Einstein's static universe.
Anyways,
it's zero. Okay.
Well, anyway, so we considered this result before starting. So this was a reason to start about thinking about this this type of calculation.
You do in four dimensions this calculation?
Yeah. Well, in principle, we try to do something more general, but
because there should be a difference between even and odd dimension.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, there are like there are several things that are clear. For example, this for the free case, particle production is really different. But for the interacting, also Polyakov is saying that it's different for the interacting theory. But precisely, I would like to do a small remark on that, just in a minute. But well, the thing is that they we couldn't get much farther with this because, well, you all know, it's intuitive that this, this the other part of the equality is going to diverge very badly. So we couldn't compare these two results at the end. So if we try to do this in for the global case, for the global case, this calculation for the global case, then this is the interval we get.
Excuse me, Roberto, so the previous slide was for the global also coordinates?
No.
Coordinate free.
What do you mean?
No, I'm sure it wasn't coordinate free. I'm sure it's in the poker.
We were working.
That is the invariant.
Yeah, no, that of course I know, but the point is that you have to specify, it will be important when you actually do the detailed calculation, mm-hmm. whether you work in specially flat coordinates, for instance. Uh-huh. That will select a certain state. If you use some sort of Poisson prescription or something like that, then there it will matter.
So I don't know if you refer to this second line, but I mean this is in the cosmological part. But what we tried was to do it in global context.
Yeah, but this process in Einstein static universe contradicts energy conservation. Mm-hmm. And there is definitely an Einstein static universe energy conservation. Energy is conserved.
But this is not his result, right?
Huh? So, no.
This is not his result. So let's discuss his result.
He's not responsible.
Can argue with it.
I mean,
excuse me, the point of the Einstein static universe is that the center is conformal to a finite piece of the Einstein static cylinder. You have intervals over finite pitches of time, you don't get energy conservation.
Yeah, that would if
we try to do this in four dimensions, in global coordinates, then we get something that is very badly divergent. And there's nothing much to do after that because this is the form of the integral.
0 to 0 or 0 to 4?
0 to 0. Now it's the opposite part of the equality. And so this can be shown analytically to be divergent.
The infrared divergence, or how it diverges? Divergence from where?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not so sure about that, because the shape of the divergence is like this. So, well, of course, this is going to be divergence in the sense that it's proportional to the space-time volume. Didn't say that. But even taking into account that, I don't even expect it to be finite, like I'm interested in the imaginary part, that's my point. So even the imaginary, here you can see that the imaginary part, because of some funny I factors probably, the part we are interested in here is the real part of this expression. The real part, it has nothing to do with the I epsilon prescription in principle. You can show analytically that it's divergent with this, well, this approximate shape. It's not exactly that, but so.
See, I'm a little confused about the top line there. This is supposed to be in the center, right? Where's the pressure factor?
I'm omitting it. It's there. So the measure is in the second line. You can see the measure.
You're saying this diverges. The imaginary part diverges worse than the space-time volume.
Worse. I don't know how to compare that, but it's really easy to figure out. It's not a difficult computation. So, well, after that, we only have a couple of remarks regarding this approach. You told me something about the even and odd dimensionalities. Polyakov actually says something like you're not going to get any imaginary part in, I think it's in even dimensionalities. Actually, the formula I showed you before, I think this formula is for example, I think it's for for dimension 3 in his paper. So, but this in principle, this contradicts the fact that this unitarity approach is general. So, it's impossible to get a single imaginary bar for even dimensionality, because the only thing we are changing from dimension 3 to dimension 4 is some number, some n.
So the point is the orientation of the manifold. I mean, in even dimension, you can make a tour through the complex and get back to the manifold with the same orientation as you cannot in all dimension. So you can make a deformation in the integrals in complex space-time and get back to the same integral with the opposite sign or with the same sign. So in one case you can say that something is zero, in the other case you cannot. It's a geometric fact.
One more comment. Actually, he other way around. In even dimensions, you have imaginary part. In even space-time dimensions, you have imaginary part. In odd space-time dimensions, you don't. But just because in odd space-time dimensions, you have even number of negative modes.
Are you saying that he was wrong?
No. Is not a god, right? He can be wrong.
Yes.
But I'm not saying that he's wrong.
No, I mean, I'm saying that it's wrong in some sense, because so if you try, my point is that if you try to calculate the imaginary bar for even or odd dimensionalities, you have to calculate something like this to some power in whatever theory, of, let's say for myself. And the only thing that changes, if you say that this is finite, well, actually,
can you use light show?
White show more visible.
Well, this is the other way.
The back side.
Sorry. I'm omitting the measure. So, if this is finite for us, if this is going to be finite in some dimension, for example, dimension 3, I think this is going to be finite also for any other dimension, because the only thing, to increase the number, the dimensionality of space-time doesn't change at all. So it makes better the asymptotic behavior of this variator. So if we get this to be finite in dimension 3, I'm pretty sure that this is going to be finite.
The question is if it is zero or not zero.
Is it zero in odd dimensional spacetimes for particle production, and then unparticle production it just rotates back to where it was before? Right? Doesn't have any physical context. It may not have anything to do with particles. It's just you sort of produce particles when you unproduce them in the same way. That's what
I have to think about that. Yeah. Let's see if it works. Besides the possibility that the asymptotic regions are not well defined, the only we thought in principle of about some phase space possibility. The possibility of a phase space divergence, since we expect, in principle, we expect the amplitude, not the decay wave, to be finite. But if the decay wave is divergent, then perhaps the phase space is playing some role. I'm not so sure about that now. So the only thing, there's also something that is. That is bothering us, that perhaps So we can, in principle, we cannot compare the calculation by Higuchi and Hatsushi and ours because of the two different portions of space time. But if we forget for a second about that, it's not clear at all that the way that we got rid of the well-known infinite volume infrared divergence in the cosmological patch is equivalent to the gap that we got rid of in the global patch. So I'm just trying to stress the fact that we have two different infinite volumes here. Well, I'm two different volumes, infinite volumes here in the global patch and the cosmological patch. So this thing seems to be contradictory. Just assuming that they are equivalent at some point. Just wanted to stress that. Well, I think this unitary thing is an interesting possibility to check all these claims about the stability of vacuum, of the vacuum. And in this minute I have, let me say just that this talk is more or less refers to my opinion a couple of months ago, but since I'm spending some time in Tufts University, it was enough to have a brief conversation with Ben Slayer in the audience to try to understand the other approach to the theory. So, well, just to say that. Of course, if we think that this analytic continuation works, that is a nice idea. I think it's a nice idea. Then, of course, the infrared divergence disappears. Divergence is disappeared, but then I would like to understand this particle production phenomena from the point of view of an static observer, because if I consider a regular observer with an interactive theory in cosmic time, I'm kind of sure that even when some processes like this are allowed, I'm not going to see any any explosive particle production. I'm just to remain the thermal state. So if we try to transfer this lesson from flat space to the real space, from the real space to the static patch, and well, I'm quite sure that we can examine this question. So I would be glad to hear any suggestion about this idea of just comparing. So if we consider this. The individual monks in these regions, we can ask ourselves how coupling interaction makes them rotate between them or something. So, since the theory is really similar between the real space and the static patch, there are a lot of similarities. Somehow, I think that it's going to be strange if we get something different in the static point of view than in the real point. Real case, and that's all. Thank you.
Any questions? I would like to understand this gamma. Is that a production rate per unit time, or is the production per unit time
and unit volume?
Because if I looked at that diagram that you showed, 0 to 4, or either 0 to 3, for the conformal mass phase, I mean, the mode functions there are the same as in Minkowski. As Don has just pointed out, the only difference is that eta, which is the conformal
time,
has a finite domain.
Yeah.
But if I do those integrals here, I'm going to get those sine functions of E1, E2, E3, E4, divided by the denominators, E1 plus E2 plus E3 plus E4.
Mm-hmm.
So there are no resonant denominators. When I square that object, it's a finite number. there are no resonant denominators, that would give me a time dependence times a Donegal delta function. That's the way typically works.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't understand, if you calculate a production rate, that object, it has to, it shouldn't be a constant.
Yeah,
it should actually fall down with that. With time, because you have an oscillatory behavior there, and you know there is not—it's not particle production there. Those diagrams, in particular, are there in Minkowski space-time in a Fokker representation of the exact vacuum.
So this behavior,
so there is no resonant denominator for Fermi's golden rule to work. To give
you a total sense. I know what you're saying. So, don't worry about this this diagram. In the
that's what you were saying.
Yeah, in the cosmological slicing, right? Yeah, it's true that I've considered this possibility that you are telling to me, because this calculation it wasn't so clear at first sight that the method that Hatsushi Giguchi used to do it, but in fact there are several possibilities. I have this is kind of a different thing, but I have discussing the possibility of regularizing this integral in a different form. So if you regularize the integral in a different form, you get really different answers. That doesn't work with the Fermi's golden rule. So yeah, I'm not quite sure about this, the strength of this constant decay rate, but I guess this is not exactly a question for me. This causes a rabbit, because I'm really interested.
May I just comment? So actually, mathematically, it's infinite, right? The results are infinite, so you use physical intuition to come up with infinity times a constant. So that's what was done, really. So maybe you have to...
No. If you calculate the Minkowski, I agree that half Minkowski may have problems. But if you calculate the Minkowski in this diagram, it's a trivial textbook exercise.
Yes.
It's basically the integral minus infinity to infinity with some adiabatic regulator of e to the I, the sum of the frequencies. Okay. So that gives you a sine function of the sum of all the energies divided by a denominator, which is the sum of all the energies.
So minus infinity to zero, the time.
So it's a sine of the sum E1 plus E2 plus E3 divided by E1 plus E2. You square that, there are no resonant denominators, it's not proportional to time.
Yeah, so you can, I'll give you the reference, so we can look up that and see what I do.
Minkowski space time is three.
Yeah.
Last question. Yeah, so I mean, in this integral that you're trying to find, if you take the imaginary part of the finite, right? That's what you say. Why don't you just?
But you get rid of that.
Well, the last one.
You get rid of square root of minus g.
M0.
I'm not sure if you can
associate the divergence with the time variable, because
it's just a fact. So why don't you just integrate the theta and then do Mathematica and plot it, as a function of time?
It's a function of...
numerically integrate and see what you get.
No, but you can do it.
You can.
Yeah.
An infinite cylinder.
I mean, this result that I have seen is...
Oh, you have done it all.
It's analytical.
Okay, so we have a coffee break and we can start dying at 4 or 5.